we have down here is the fourth one now, on headship and submission. And that's more than just dealing with the husband-wife roles. It's dealing with the understanding of how Christ leads the church and his love for the church. And it has a whole lot to do with being submissive to God's will as well as being submissive to each other's will. Sexual preparation for the honeymoon. Now, some of you may feel uncomfortable getting into this, but I suppose it's because in our work in counselling people who've had difficulties in marriage, that we feel a bit braver. But again, we rely heavily on Dr. Ed Wheat's material there. But we are prepared to talk about it simply because, again, the disappointment that many couples have on their honeymoon is not a myth. We've had two or three couples who were Christians, and two of them at least were from our assemblies, who came to see us only days after their honeymoon. And one of those couples has split. And they split largely over ignorance. We had not seen them in pre-marriage counselling, but they came to see us because they had a problem. Now, we're not saying that their whole of their problem would have been resolved if they had had a better understanding about the sexual anatomy and function and so on. But we are convinced that there is a big area of disappointment for two reasons. One, the world is giving a wrong perspective on television, and that's where most kids are getting their ideas. You have to recognise that. We actually were asking when we first started with the pre-marriage counselling, and we found out that they were reading Cosmopolitan and Clio. They were the two magazines because they were providing girls with the information. And some of that information is medically incorrect. So we have to be, there is a need here. And I think if you look at stuff written by H. Norman Wright, he does touch some of this as well. And using the tapes, it is necessary for you to do that. And the last session we have cover is communication and conflict resolution and money management. Now, we didn't put money management and conflict together, meaning that's always the way it is. But if the relationship is not functioning well, you're going to have money problems. Now, there's material available. Graham Maynard actually prepared material, David, some years ago, I think, when we were doing those things here. And other material available for money management. But when you talk about money to kids, you've also got to talk about goals. If you haven't got their goals sorted out, it's really just separate from, almost. They can be quite good at managing money, but if the money isn't being spent in the way they want to live, there'll be great tension. I don't know whether you've heard this or not, but Larry Burkett, who's writing quite a bit, is saying to young couples, start saving $10 per week and don't touch it until you retire at 65. And if you save $20, that is both of you putting in $10 per week and you don't touch it. This was based on when interest rates were around about 9-10%. You'll have roughly $1 million at retirement. Now, most people can't believe that. The other thing is most people can't keep their fingers out of that fund. So you're dealing with a whole thing there, but it's worth mentioning to these people, because some of them are fairly conscientious young people and they will look at this and say, okay, it would mean that I could then use my life in such and such, and Christian work could benefit greatly. All right, now we don't lock ourselves into those things, but we rely heavily on how the kids, and I'm speaking now to mostly young married couples coming, how they respond in answering the questionnaire on the expectations. I suppose the thing that has really got to us has been the fact that you have to overcome the infatuation stage. And this is always a problem. Whenever you have a couple who seem to be so in love with each other that they can't answer your questions, it ought to let the yellow flashing lights get going, because it means that one of them probably isn't thinking. And it's worse if both of them are in this state. We've come to the conclusion that we need to look for equality in the couple. If we notice that only one can answer questions, only one volunteers, one always looks to the other before they say anything, we think, hey, something's not right. Now, it may not always be wrong, but at least we're looking for the weaknesses, if you like. We also are concerned when we find that one is not a reader, one has no interest in reading, one even transmits the feeling that they are not appreciative of your asking them personal questions, and the other one is doing everything. They are making sure every T is crossed and every I is dotted. And you think, hang on, if this is how it is now, what's it going to be like in 5 to 10 years? Because one is so laid back, you see. And it's amazing how one who is laid back will be attractive to one who is a nitpicker. And there's a book back there, you might have not seen it. It's called Opposites Attack by the Mayhalls. And it is so true. They're attracted in the early stages because it's cool. If you're an anxious, uptight person, to be going with a guy who's laid back and doesn't worry about anything, that's a great relief. But when you're married to him and you can't move him, that's a problem. And this often happens. When you notice that you've got some major differences, look through your files, look through your books, and you might find just one chapter out of one book. It's worth sharing it, because once they marry, they've lost the leverage. They really have. They've lost the leverage about bringing change. But until they're married, and we say to them, look, until you're married, you know, you've got all the leverage in the world. And they smile at each other when you say that, thinking that they would never do anything like that. But it's true. They do. And do you know that a guy who wants to marry this girl, he will just about do anything to get her. Now, in the back of most men's minds, once they've got her, then they relax. And that's where the problem comes. But it is true that you do have, in pre-marriage counselling, you do have a great opportunity to notice what you consider to be inequalities or inequities, and then suggest remedies, and do it now. Don't wait till 6 months after they're married. Somebody brought the matter up, I think David mentioned earlier, the matter of what do you do if it looks like a girl's going to change her mind or a fella's going to change his mind. If there's any chance, you mentioned, no, somebody did. Might have been, oh, I forget. Yeah, that's right. If there's any possibility that you can help them to come to their senses and call it off, do it. Do it. We had a guy call us, they'd been for 2 sessions, and he called and he said, I am not at all comfortable with how this is going. And I wasn't sure whether he was having a go at us or how they were doing. And he said, I've got real questions. I said, brother, if you have real questions, you need to get that settled in your own mind and tell the girl. The only trouble was he chose Valentine's Day to tell her. They'd already mailed the invitations. Now, it was just as well. Just as well. It is better that these kids understand that this is a big step. Many of the people who will come to you for to be married are people who have cruised into it. They literally have, it's the only natural thing to do is to get married. And they have not looked at the size of marriage. And say to them, it's not something you take on, it's something that will change your life. It has to be that big. And so you need to be able to encourage them. Now the problem is, if you're good friends with their parents, that does pose a problem. But you do need to be honest enough to say, hey, it's their life and they have to make a sound choice. Now, I think as far as how do you present stuff to them when you see a problem, you can't say to them, you've got to do it my way. You know, if you don't listen to us, you're really getting out of the will of God. You can't say that. So what do? You give them the options. And you can say to them, if we were in your shoes, we would be suggesting this and that and the other. You have to work it out. But don't let them off the hook. When they see you next time, how did you work it out? What resolution have you come to? And if they haven't come to any, then you really do need to think seriously about proceeding. Yes, I thought you were putting your hand up there, Stace. We don't feel that, Grace and I at least, don't feel that we are experts in this area. We don't look at it in the same depth that David has as far as preparing for the wedding, in that we've only just recently become, I've only just become a celebrant in the last 12 months. So most of our pre-marriage stuff has been where people have come to us and then the person that's marrying them still does the preparation for the wedding and that sort of thing. And we probably will need to take a little bit further steps in developing stuff surrounding the ceremony and so on. One ceremony that I have done, I've typed the whole thing out on the computer, and if any of you are looking for an outline, I'd be happy to let you see it, and if you want a copy, by all means. And that was largely taken from the stuff that Dave gave me that came out, I think, of a Baptist order of service. But couples these days are wanting to write their own. A lot are wanting to write their own. So you just have to be flexible on that. All right. Talking about post-counselling. Yes. Yes. Why did I get this? Right.
I like that. Does it taste good if you lick it? Oh, good. Going back to Norm Wright again, in his premarital counselling, I guess he calls it, he does a very interesting thing. Because he's working on a university campus or a college campus and gets to know a lot of these kids from classes, a lot of couples who are going together, because of the reputation that he's established over the years, will come to him and say, as we've had said to us, we think we're on the right track. We think we've made the right choice, but we'd really like to talk this through with somebody. We need some confirmation that we're not just on our own. A lot of these are kids that are away from home. They live 1,000 miles away from home, and they really don't have anybody they can talk to. Anyway, Norm has set up a program of 6 sessions with these young people, with these young couples, before they announce their engagement. Now, that makes an awful lot of sense to us. Mm. And you know what he says? 50% of them never get engaged. Because they can see that there are such enormous things, such hurdles to jump, that they just can see that they would that they could make a lot wiser choice waiting for somebody else. Now, I think that's interesting. The early part of last year, we had 4 engaged couples going simultaneously. One was this couple that Jim just mentioned. 2 of the 4 broke up. And we were sitting there scratching our heads, feeling a bit bad, thinking, you know, this isn't too good for the reputation. But the more we thought about it, we realized we may have helped to avert 2 divorces. Mm. Better to break the engagement when you see that the thing is wrong than to struggle all your life in a miserable marriage or wind up getting divorced. So that was one thing.
And Grace, can I just highlight that what Grace said there is in that premarital counselling by Norman Wright, and not only the 6... not only the content of the 6 sessions that he has with the pre-engagement people, but his rationale is all in the book.
And I guess one reason that I have become increasingly concerned about this pre-engagement stuff, one is because this young fellow that Jim referred to said to us, there are a lot of young people out there who want to do it right, but they've got nobody to talk to. They want some help. So that's why 12 months ago we tried to put together a pre-engagement weekend that fell almost flat on its face.
Well, it's been successful. One couple got married.
They both did. 2 couples came. One was already engaged looking for confirmation, and the other couldn't quite make up their mind, have since married, and as far as we know, they're all fine. But there wasn't a great surge of people that wanted to come to that, and yet we believe that couple by couple, there are young people out there who, just like this guy said, want to do it right, but who do you talk to?
Maybe they take the engagement too lightly, whereas what an engagement is a promise.
That's right.
Marriage. And this is where the actual marriage counselling should take place, premarital counselling should take place prior to the engagement, because this is the promise of marriage.
A lot of Christians, I think, find it hard to break the engagement because They've made a promise. Yeah, a statement that they're going to get married.
Well, doesn't this fall back on our assemblies? I mean to say, as I listen to all of this, and I've done a bit of counselling, but as I listen to all of this, in India, I saw one couple have problems. And that went not just for all the years we were there, but all the years before. The first couple. Now, they never see one another. They meet, and their marriage is fixed. It's all up in the brain box. And I think half a dozen counselling classes before the wedding, it seems to be inadequate. We're not getting at the world properly enough in our assemblies.
No, I think this is something that things like Y-Link have got to take. We've got to put into the youth programs that are around at the moment. We've got to get to the youth at the youth program. Even if it's only a 10-minute segment of a program, it needs to be brought in on a regular basis in a relationship style of way.
Oh, yeah.
You can't do enough of it. And however, you're not going to get, as you found, you're not going to get kids to commit themselves to a weekend on marriage, They're only going to commit themselves to somebody for their life, but let's not spend a weekend doing something about it. But we've got to hit it. We've got to hit the problem at an earlier stage and build towards something. That's the way I see it. Proactive. Somehow.
We've come to a conclusion that there really aren't any marriages that can't work, but it takes two people to make them work. Now, I think that's a different mindset from the society that we live in these days because, like you, you're saying these arranged marriages, I mean, they've never clapped eyes on each other in many cases before. Now, what makes those marriages work? Well, the social pressures are different, for a start. The external pressures are somewhat different in the situation that they're living in, but they make it work. It may not be heaven on earth, but they make the thing work, and we think there is no marriage that's doomed to fail. Now, we've heard that phrase, and you may have too. Oh, our marriage was just doomed from the beginning. There aren't any marriages that are doomed from the beginning unless you're not prepared to work at them. There are lots that fail, but I do think that's part of it. Then two of these, and the significance of engagement has changed. It's changed in society at large, and it has changed because a lot of society at large rubs off on us as Christians, and particularly on young people, who want the social acceptance and the fun and the standing and the belongingness that comes with being married. But we're working with couples where the girl's wearing an engagement ring. They've announced their engagement, but she has confessed to us that she's still trying to decide whether this is the guy she wants to spend the rest of her life with, wearing his ring. It's a very different climate than it was a few years ago. So even the purpose of engagement has changed. Another thing that we've found that again comes back to not only assemblies but churches in general, our young people really don't seem to be, in many cases, being challenged to see where does the possibility of Christian service, where does God's call on our life come into this? And we are staggered at kids from Christian homes, where both of them are from churches around the place. They come to us from pre-marriage counseling who have never given it a thought. Just never, ever considered that God may have a plan for them to fit into. Missionary service, farthest thing from their minds. Oh, they might trot off for just a little while with teen missions or something, but no long-term commitment. Then I think, too, for young girls, and I can only speak as a girl, maybe guys don't work this way, I don't know, but for you men who are doing this kind of stuff, you need to know that girls are dying to get married because of the belongingness of it. And it's just not socially acceptable to not be married. There are not very many girls that can live comfortably with that. And I think there are many who find a guy, not that they're excited to pieces and so proud to think that they're going to be a team with this guy, they're going to be a couple, but they can tolerate him. And if they think they can tolerate him, they want to be married so bad that they'll put up with him. And they're the ones, if you can say, are doomed from the beginning. They're the ones that are doomed. Because there's,
What sort of things do you look for to be able to determine?
I don't think that you can tell. You can't tell by looking any more than you can tell by lots of things.
I think what happens after you finish counselling. I mean, the number of girls who've said to Grace at the door as they leave something that they wouldn't be game to say in the session. Or the phone calls. That's where you're likely to pick up the vibes that something's not quite right.
But this is the advantage, again, of working as a couple. Because you're both involved. The girl's not likely to call you, but she may well call your wife.
One said to us, Shookers, oh, he's a man.
Well, this is what I was saying before, is that why are we getting so many of our Christian girls marrying non-Christian blokes?
Yeah.
But also, David, it goes worse than that. I can take you to half a dozen young men right now, and they're in their 40s, 45s. And those guys are going to end up very, very lonely men. And one of them said something to me. It was a joke, but it wasn't a joke. But he virtually said, I'm not losing my home. Because of some of the attitude that's around, that you can easily go into marriage, easily walk out of it. You get a 50-50 split. In fact, I can take you to a man that the same girl did to him twice. She got the 100%. This is what we're battling. When I start talking to people to counsel them, some of them can't write out half a dozen Bible verses, and they're 22 and 23 and 24 years old. And you think, where's the basis to start this on?
Problem here, which I don't think too many people recognise, is the performance of assembly marriage. They do not show love to one another in the home, as far as the children can see. And in fact, sometimes they carry this man to the head of the home point to the place where the woman's seen as being downtrodden, even by the children. And this starts the seed going with some of these failed marriages because they expect different things and they've got the wrong slant because some of our older marriages have this real division of roles and this is the head and this is the servant, so to speak, and they proceed along that. There's not much shown of love day by day. You know, we're not talking about going into bed at night. We're talking about what happens in the day. As I tried to say to someone, if you're talking sex, your best sex starts immediately after the first one. Right? In other words, I'm not saying it's sex, it's the love and the atmosphere that's created. And sex is just nothing if there's not this loving atmosphere right through the whole home. But that's what's missing in a number of our older married folk. You know, well, they're a staid old couple. That's about all that's said of them. There's not
just
much
the
demonstration.
Just the brethren rights.
Well, we don't want to start criticising now, brother.
But
you're right.
To get our older people to see that they're not living a real married life, which gives the role model for the children coming on. They're just two people living in the same house with a piece of paper that says they're married. And beyond that, there doesn't seem to be any commitment to loving one another in a real love.
Fred, we've been conducting marriage seminars now for about 16, well, more than that, 18 years. And, you know, we still hear it. Oh, what do we need to go to a marriage seminar for? You know, what can they teach us? I mean, they're only young people, those vines. And used to be we were once. But the point is that by them as part of a church not being involved, what message are they giving to the rest of the church? And this is a true problem. We have people who think, oh, if we go to a seminar, people think we have a problem. All of us have problems. We're all sinners saved by grace. And we recognise that we can all grow. And if you get this teachableness into the next generation, that's probably more valuable than being perfect. And this being prepared to say, yes, we need to learn some new ideas. But I think that's true. I think that is a problem. It is difficult sometimes in the normal teaching program of an assembly or a church to include nitty-gritty stuff. But the principle certainly needs to be shared. And maybe there needs to be more teaching in the whole concept of what is the oneness between Christ and the church that ought to be between husbands and wives. Now that can be taught as an academic subject pretty well from the pulpit without getting into the detail. But if it's taught in a sensitive way and taught biblically soundly with genuine couples that are known in the church to be warm couples, I think that helps. Actually, I'll
on that. Yeah. I preached one time, this sort of like mine, and said, husbands, how many times have you turned up with a bunch of flowers for your wife or something like that? Just like, and the fellow, around, not quite my own age, but clearly, had the audacity to come up to me after he said, I solved that problem. He said, when I first gave her a bunch of flowers, I gave her a bunch of reserved flowers, and I never had to do a thing. So that's what he said to me.
Yeah, sprinkle water on them so they look a bit shiny. All right. Now, if we can just switch gears, David, for a little while before afternoon tea, over to post-marriage counselling.
Yes. Before we move on, just one. I appreciate your comments on the whole aspect of trust and confidentiality when you're with couples.
Yes. Okay, the question is trust and confidentiality. Yes. Yes, I think this is essential, and I think you need to have an understanding with the couple. You need to tell them when you first see them that you're not reporting back to the elders of the church, you're not reporting to their parents, and everything that's shared in this room will stay there. Now, where you are legally, if they reveal something that is of an illegal nature, that's between you and the Lord and the law, but you need to know the law on that count. And unless it is something pretty horrific, I'd say it just stays in that room. But it has to be total. We're dealing with a couple at the moment that it would be very damaging if anything leaked. And I think you will, before you're done, you'll have that experience. Yeah. So it has to be confidential. As far as the law in preparation for the wedding stuff like that, that needs to be out in the open between the couple. We had a couple arrive once, and the lady was in tears, and we found out that she had just been told that day, 6 months married, she'd just been told that day they could never ever go back to her home country because the police wanted him.
Oh.
Yep. And that just wiped her out. You know, and that need never have happened. If somebody had talked to him in pre-marriage saying, okay, if you guys got anything you haven't shared, you need to do it this week. And don't see us until you've shared everything. Now, of course, that may not have stopped him. But if he had shared that, he may never have married the girl. Truth's none. But I think we have to be, as far as we're concerned. Now, when you're not working with your wives, if you're doing counselling together, you might want to say sometime, look, I do need to be able to share this with my wife. Especially if the woman is bringing up something that ought to be shared with a woman, not just with you. I recognise that's a bit of a problem, and one Theo College that Grace and I were asked to speak at never invited us back because we suggested that they should include their wives, and somebody suggested to us that maybe it was because we were taking away from the authority of the pastor. I'm not sure that's necessarily a biblical authority there, but anyway, we have to think about that. Yes?
Just a couple of things on pre-marriage counseling. I think that we're moving into an area where you need to be more explanatory and firm with your discussion of finances.
Yes.
Now, I've run into a couple of couples where they got married, and I've stand up and do the marriage, I've met them since, and they decided to both keep on working. They both contributed to the finances. But then she stops to have a baby, so now her household expenses, she only gets half because she only gets him giving in still the same amount. She's not earning anything, and she gets nothing for clothing or anything like that. Because he doesn't have to provide her clothing. That's her worry. Now, I think we need to point out that this is a sharing business. Mm-hmm. And it's not, what's mine's mine, what's... it's got to be shared. Mm.
And I think that we're in an age where you've got to point that out more often, because this is being put across in all the things that you're still individual, you still have your own money, you still have your own possessions.
Do your own thing.
Do your own thing. In fact, I've heard two civil celebrants tell them to stay that way at the marriage because they're two individuals. Now, we don't believe that. We believe the two become one. They've got to become one in everything. And that's a problem there.
We have a couple at the moment. We've finished seeing them now. We have to have two sessions after they marry. And she's struggling with letting her name go. Mm.
Mm.
So we're going to see that more and more. Mm.
Might I also go to the sex situation? Now, I sort of shied away from this a bit when I first started, but I found after one circumstance that I almost get to the point where I'm very blunt. And that is, it is possible for both male and female to need surgery to enjoy sex. And I had one case where both were in trouble and they both had to have surgery. But that honeymoon was a disaster as far as they were concerned. So I think you need to point this out to them.
Ed Wheat says it's less than 0.8 of 1%.
But does happen.
If that happens, and they're couples that you've married and they end up, you know, in strife, well, it's worth mentioning it. And Ed Wheat does mention that on his tape. So.
There's another assumption I think we all make, and that is that the kids know all about it.
That is not true.
And that is not true. Because, as you say, they get it from Cleo and Cosmopolitan, Playboy and this sort of stuff. And they do not know all about it, and that doesn't matter how promiscuous the society seems to be, they do not know all about it. But I find it very difficult to talk about, and consequently my suggestion to them always is that they must discuss that side of it with their own physician. Go and talk to the physician about sex and this sort of thing.
Don't know how to talk about it either.
Yes. There are some doctors who do.
Yeah,
and if you can find doctors that you know who are prepared to get into the emotional side, not just the anatomy side, that's more important than the anatomy side.
Yeah.
I always send those tapes to the couples.
Good.
That's the Ed Wheat tapes, sex technique and sex problems in marriage. And yes. It's been a big help for them.
Yeah, they are very good.
Do you love most of your pre-marrieds?
Sorry.
Do you loan those to your pre-marrieds?
Normally, in the last counselling time, yes. And I want it back at the time of the rehearsal.
Yeah. It's just that that particular set of tapes isn't written for engaged couples. It's farther down the track. And that's the beauty of Before the Wedding Night.
Yeah.
Because that is where they are.
Tremendously.
Yeah. Because otherwise they're bringing up problems that have potential down the track.
Yes.
And it puts a big cloud of fear over the thing, because 99% of what he talks about is never going to happen anyway. So that's the beauty of Before the Wedding Night. That's what they're for.
Don, you sometimes will even get the comment, particularly from the girl. She'll say, look, I don't want to be worried about what I've read in books or listened to tapes. I just want to go away on my honeymoon and enjoy it. Now, in actual fact, that is probably a great idea. And this is where, as teachers, you've got to back off and say, okay, we want you to get a biblical concept. We want you to have all the facts. But then you've got to internalise it and be free enough. You've got to know the material well enough to be not wanting to turn the light on to read a book so that they can, in fact, just relax.
Just hang on.
And kids will recognise this. And you know, they'll say, that's right. And this is why to give them the material just a week before is a bit rough sometimes. We say to guys, you need to listen to that second tape on Before the Wedding Night 3 times. Because the guy has to change his thinking. We think it's that important. Okay, do we want to move on to the marriage counselling now?
And this probably affects maybe me a little more than the others, and this is one of the main reasons I wanted to pursue being a celebrant, is in our school context. We'd be very naive and idealistic to assume that they're not sexually active, some of our students, which, just because of Christian school really doesn't assume they're all Christians, and even those who are even Christians or have claimed to be Christians, that has been the case as well. So how do those sort of issues raised in terms of engaged couples or couples who want to see you or whatever, because I mean that's an area that you wouldn't know about necessarily.
No.
But boy, oh boy, I'd be fairly silly if I wasn't to acknowledge that I believe amongst our students it's a real problem.
Well, this is part of your teaching, and I think that you would, in this preparation for sexual intimacy on the honeymoon, you would need to be saying to them, now God's standard is that sex be intercourse be maintained only in marriage. And I think that all of the material from Ed Wheat particularly and the Penners reinforces this. The establishment of a standard. We encourage them to talk about it. And actually, if there's no sexual attraction, we think there's a problem. In other words, if there's not a struggle, they really need to talk to somebody. But then we encourage them to set a line beyond which they will not go. You see, if the guy cannot be trusted before he's married, the chances are she won't trust him after she marries him. So in other words, if his headship is not to be in question, he must remain sexually trustworthy and maintain a godly standard.
This is where what David said before is so correct. This is what has got to be put through from the youngest kids we've got. I ran into a man, and that guy said to his son, and I've got proof of it, son, I failed, and you will fail. And I was horrified, and that kid has failed. And that kid's in trouble today. Now, if we're not going to teach that this is what a Christian is, and if we're not going to bring the facts out right from their young, then when we get to the time where they're about to get married, well, you can take them to the forgiveness of God, but they've lost something that they'll never get back.
That's right. That can be taught, I think, from the pulpit solidly and carefully, the matter of being faithful. Ten Commandment is, you will not commit adultery, you will be faithful because I am faithful. In other words, the Ten Commandments just a picture of the character of God. And I think when we teach it that way, we can cover that.
How many people really have a clear view that marriage and sex in marriage is an object lesson of the relationship that God wants to have with us? That's what makes marriage sacred. But the outside kids, you non-Christian kids, have no concept of that. And our Christian churches and Christian families aren't saying it. So what's the difference? The kids wind up with no idea that that's what it's all about.
All right. Any other question on pre-marriage? We'll move on to counselling after marriage. We think that there is a big difference here. Yes, you're still a teacher, but now you are a counsellor. Now, by that, I don't mean that you are a qualified social worker or psychologist. Grace and I have learned through experience, but we still don't consider ourselves to be experts. There is, in fact, probably 90% of any success that the Lord may have allowed us to have is our ability to listen. Confidentiality and listening is very important. You will probably find that the majority of those who come to you for marriage help are looking for a pair of ears. And if you can walk through the pain with them and you can try to get them together, we've taken the view that counselling individuals is sometimes counterproductive. You are better when you're dealing with marriage problems, you are better to deal with the husband and the wife together. Now, after you get started, you might find that it's wise to split them up. And your wife will talk to the wife and you will talk to the bloke. And then you get back together again. But if you want to get through to the truth quicker, you need them both present. You will go on for weeks with half stories if you're individually counselling. Now, this isn't because people want to deceive you. It is because they might not want to divulge anything that's going to be put poor light on their spouse or poor light on themselves, but they don't think it's important for you to know all the facts. Now, when you've got the two together, what the bloke thinks is important is often different from what the girl thinks is important. So you're likely to get what's important from both points of view sooner. That's the first thing. The second thing is that what you are doing as a couple, if you work as a couple, you are letting them see another couple function in front of them. And that is important. People will absorb the feel of your relationship when they walk into your home. Which brings up a second point. We think the counselling should be done in your home, not the counsellee's home. When you go to somebody else's home, you're at the mercy of their telephone, their kids, and anything else that they want to have set up to trap you or to waste time. I suppose wasting time is not a spiritual thing to talk about, but sometimes, as Christians, we do have our time wasted. And when you can have them coming to your home or to your office, you're in control and you have a better chance of getting the best use of the time. We have some forms again for that, and on that table up the end you're welcome to help yourself to some forms that we have found help to get the information out. Now, what do you do when people shock you? In other words, they will tell you that they're doing something that is absolutely shocking. Try your dead level best not to react. Apart from fainting, you should be able to control yourself. Younger people sometimes do this deliberately. Older people don't. We had a young couple from a fairly tight assembly, not represented here today. And honestly, one of them just spoke about the other one in most derogatory terms. You could not believe it. Married 12 months. And the question went through our minds, what preparation did this pair get? And I have a sneaking suspicion they didn't get a lot. The sad thing is they couldn't go to anybody in their own church. Now, I would be encouraging you, when people do say shocking things, the first thing to do is to somehow or other rephrase the question to make sure you heard right. Because as you get older, Don, you've got to watch this sort of thing. And sometimes in a counselling session, the person who is talking feels so down that their volume drops and you can hardly hear what they're saying. So you might have to stop and say, look, I'm getting old. Can you just speak up? And sometimes the tears flow and you can't get much more from that particular person. All I'm saying is the major gift and ability you need to do marriage counselling is that of compassion. There will be many times when you could have a verse that would just blow them out of the water, and if only they'd listened to it years before, they wouldn't be in trouble. But that's past history. They've blown it. You are now dealing with how do you restore. Now, there's a book which we haven't got with us today which we would highly recommend to you by Everett Worthington called Marriage Counseling. And Everett Worthington is on the faculty of Virginia International University. And I think I got more out of that book. I was reading it up at Harvey Bay, Don, when we were up there over Christmas. I got more out of that book than a lot of the other stuff that I've read. And in that, he deals with blame and sin and forgiveness. And he spends two chapters or three chapters on those topics. And I think as Christian marriage advisors or counsellors, if you like, we need to have a good biblical view of those three things. Blame, sin and forgiveness. And I think you will find that there are so many issues that will come up that you will see clear biblical illustrations of how the Lord has done stuff for us. See, the more you can point back to the Lord, you are really on the right track. Grace and I have just finished reading another book called the one that talks about not problem solving but solution based. Right. This, I think, is also helpful. modern psychiatry and psychology and most of the social workers that are functioning today are working on solving the problem. And they generally work back into the families of origin and so on. And we're not saying that that's not a factor. But from a Christian perspective, if we don't get the couple focused on the solution, we are not providing the light that they need. And in our case, it is Christ's working in our life, works in the individual's life, who then with the help of the Spirit is able to surmount whatever the problem may be.
Is the name of that Promoting Change in Brief Therapy?
Yes, Promoting Change in Brief Therapy. Yes, it's part of a series put out by the American Association of Christian Counselors. About 30 books in the series. If you want to be an expert, that's the series to buy if you're rich. But it is a valuable book, Promoting Change Through Brief Therapy. Now, the word brief therapy, that term, is a term now used in psychological circles. And what they are saying is that brief therapy, frankly, is more effective than long-term, like 2 and 3 year therapy. Brief therapy really works out in practice to 6 sessions.
Up to 20
is the maximum normally, but in average, they're saying that 6 sessions is about the average. Now, as we look back on our experience in marriage counselling, we would probably be averaging 6 or more, but around 6, that's very, very common. I would suggest you do, in the first session with a couple that comes to you, you've got to listen mostly. You've got to let them try to explain what the problem is. Why have they come to see you? Now, I've got somewhere here, session one, and that's the one we might want to photocopy, David. 4 questions for the people. What do you want to see different as a result of counselling? If they can't tell you, then you're going to have to be a mind reader, or you've got to listen to more information. Secondly, when we have finished, what would make you say that this has been worth your time and money if they're paying? So in other words, what are you expecting would be helpful? Number 3, what needs to happen for you to no longer need to come? Now, they're technically all the same question, but we're hoping people come up with answers. And 4, when the things that brought you here today have changed, what will you be doing differently? Now that affects behaviour. If you want to get an idea where we think Christian counselling ought to be, it ought to be Christian behavioural therapy. If it does not affect a person's behaviour, it is academic only. And we think there is a place. The term cognitive therapy means the use of the mind. The scripture has a lot to say about the mind. But if it doesn't affect the behaviour, because it's generally the stuff you do that annoys your spouse and vice versa, not what you think. Well, I suppose it is if you keep talking about what you think, but it's more than likely it's the things you do. Another thing that might be helpful for you to know is that in the first day, try to sort out, the first time you meet this couple, try to sort out whether they are visitors, that is, they're there because their wife conned them, and you will meet those visitors. Whether they are complainers, that's all they've come for because they're complaining about the other one, or whether they're customers, customers meaning they want to change. Now, that will be helpful if you can sort out where they are, because if you start to try to help the visitor, the visitor is going to sit there with that self-righteous view, look on his face and say, I haven't got a problem, it's all her fault. And he sits there, you know, like this. Until the visitor becomes a customer, he's not really listening. Because it's her that needs the help, you know. I've just brought her along. Now, what we have found helpful sometimes to get the husbands along, if the husband, and it's generally the husbands who don't come, by the way, We run a tape and we say to the lady, if you come on your own, he's going to think that you will divulge information to us so that when he does come, we'll know all about him, what a lousy coot he is. So what we'll do, we'll run a tape and you can take the tape home to him. And we get his name and we refer to him by name on the tape. And if we'd say, Bill, if you were here, what do you think of that? Is that a fair comment she's making? And generally, we get him next time. And it works. You've just got to have a decent tape recorder so that all the voices can be heard. But it helps to get the couple. Now, another thing that might be helpful for you also is that once you have, in this first session particularly, figured out what they are there for, then you've got to get a commitment from them to suggest that they're prepared to do homework, they're prepared to work through the processes with you as a couple. If they're not prepared to do that, you are really wasting their time. Now, what do we say then? Out the door, we don't want to see you? No, as Christians you can't do that. Do you know what it might mean? You can say to them, look, we're always as close as the phone. And it might be 6 telephone calls that Grace might get or that I might get before we see them again. But if you are able to get the compassion of Christ across to them, chances are you'll see them again. And I think this is hard for evangelists. Because the evangelist has been taught that you might never get another opportunity. And the old idea of getting the gospel through to them. But unless the Spirit of God's at work in their heart, they're not going to accept it anyhow. And sometimes I'm almost Presbyterian in my thinking. Unless God, the sovereignty of God, grabs hold of these people, you are struggling. But that doesn't mean that we give up. We still have to keep working, and we still have to keep encouraging. And I think it's interesting to know that it's some of those long-term ones that do come good. And you'll get some testimonies of those in your own experience too, I'm sure. Grace has always been a great artist. I don't know what she's doing at the moment. It says modern art, is it? Shall I get that shotgun over there, David?
Do you want to know now or later? I think he'd chase you out of here. No. That's what you were talking about.
Right.
This centre line on here, which I won't try and retrace because I won't be able to get it in the same place twice, but this centre line that was supposed to be straight down the centre is a line of reconciliation. And over here you've got a woman, a wife, who is very angry, but she still loves the guy. She'd give anything to get this marriage back on track. And then something happens and she's, I could do without him, I don't need him. So she gets back out here and then she gets lonesome. Or the kids start saying, isn't Dad coming back anymore? So she comes back and says, yeah, it really would be great to get this back on track. So she keeps coming back to this line of reconciliation. Here's a husband who, for whatever reason, is enjoying his freedom a bit, so he's out here. Now she's come to the point of reconciliation at this point. She's ready to go to work, but he's not. He may cycle in over here, and at a point in time when she's mad, she doesn't want anything to do with him. So I'm not sure I've got them coming together in the right place even then. They'll make them come together there. That's the point where you can do something helpful. Forget the rest of it. And it's why you get couples who will come and sit and you'll get a visitor. You know, your visitor may be out here. It's not his fault, it's hers. Or it's not her fault, it's his, or whatever. Because they're not both at the point right now where they're interested in doing anything about it. So, but again, when you're saying it's difficult for evangelists because you may not get another chance, that's true, and that is the temptation to try and manufacture two people to be at that point of reconciliation when they're just not there. Now that and some other very similar helpful stuff comes out of Jim Talley's book that's back there called Reconcilable Differences. We've all heard irreconcilable differences. This is reconcilable differences, and there's some brilliant stuff in it. While I'm going, can I just put up the 6 stages of change? This has been... This has been for us, and no doubt if you have gotten into counseling, that is reconstructive, trying to rebuild stuff, it's one of the most frustrating things. How do you promote change?
And you can sit and talk till you're blue in the face and people hear you and nod their heads and say, yes, thank you, we'll see you again next week. And you come back and nothing's changed. Nothing happens. How do you encourage change? I mean, this is the Holy Spirit's job, isn't it? He must shake his head over us just as much. And we more so to the sheer frustration. Well, in this book, Promoting Change in Grief Therapy, they give an interesting outline, and I've lost one of the steps, but I've got six of them here anyway.
I like them, remember.
And I just think they're interesting to put up, because we often get stuck pre-contemplative. That is, I'm not even ready to think about it yet. It's not my problem, it's his. We might stand up here looking pretty good, but you don't know what goes on at our house when we get home. And it's his fault, not mine. So I'm not even ready to own any of the blame in it as yet. Then on down the track a bit, I may be willing to think about it. And I may see, yeah, that I do have a part. It's only a very small percentage, mind you. It's only about 2%. But I do have a little bit. But I can wear that. Or something might have even happened, and I may say, look, I'm 80% responsible for what's going on. I'm 90%. And because I don't know what to do about it, somebody hasn't put an ABC outline in front of my nose and said, well, if you do this, this, and this, maybe it would help. I'm not ready for that yet. I can live with the guilt of knowing that I'm 80 or 90% responsible for a little while. Contemplative. Accepting some of the blame, living with it, thinking about it, but nothing's changed. Then one day somebody might say, you know, if you would whatever. So I adopt that and I say, yeah, that would be a good idea. Now tonight, when he comes home, I will dress like so-and-so, I will fix X for T, and I will say to him when he comes in the door, I rehearse it all in my brain, I plan it. Tonight he comes home, he comes in the door, and I didn't have time to take a shower and change my clothes, and so I've got my grubbies on that I had all day. I didn't have time to fix the nice meal that I was going to do, so I shove something quick in the oven, and I go all tongue-tied when I go to say what I was going to say, so nothing happens. So tomorrow we try again. And I plan, and I go round and round in my head. But tonight something else happens. The phone rings, the kids are sick, my mom comes, you know, there's some interruption, some something, so it doesn't work. Now, the thing is, there are people, both men and women, who can live in that contemplative or planning stage for years. And do you know if you've planned something enough times, you can convince yourself that you've done it. And this is where people get absolutely stuck, in those two places. There has to be a plan that says, at 6 o'clock tonight, come whatever, this is what I'm going to do. Or 2 o'clock tomorrow, I'm going to phone her from the office, or I'm going to take the rubbish out, or whatever. There needs to be an action that's measurable, because you can look at the clock or look at the calendar and say, on that day, I did whatever. It's measurable. You can see it. The result of that may be a very small change, but it's change. And the trouble is, when a couple comes and their marriage is sore, it hurts everywhere. It's like when you had the flu. No matter where you hurt yourself or touch yourself, your skin is just tender and sore. That's how marriages get. And you can't get a handle on it. You don't know where to start. And so we think, if anything's going to change, oh, this horrible big change is going to happen, I'm going to feel better. Suddenly I'm going to be well. And we forget to look for the little tiny changes. Maybe your headache doesn't ache quite as much today. Maybe your fever is a little bit lower today. It's the little steps that add up, finally, to a big overall in most cases. Sometimes there is an absolutely miraculous thing that happens and everything seems healed overnight. But it doesn't very often, in our experience, seem to work that way. We're talking about couples now who are in counseling or in teaching situations with you. change has happened to where the whole thing feels better. The tension level's down. The relationship feels healthier. It's not well. There are miles out there that still needs to grow, but it's a great improvement on what was. And at that point, this is what Jim was saying before, when you no longer need to come to see us, what behaviors will have changed? What will have happened? That's the point in those four questions, because there comes a point when they don't need to come see you anymore, because some things have changed, some things have happened. Now, there's a seventh one, and as I say, I can't remember what it was. Maybe that's paying the bill at the end of the term, I don't know.
Okay.
One more thing about man-woman differences. Do you know there are very few of us that know anything about man-woman differences? And one of the most valuable things we've all laughed at, and we said, but it's not a Christian book. Kurong sells it. That doesn't make it a Christian book. Is this crazy thing that's out, women are, or men are from Mars, women are from Venus. There's some brilliant stuff in there. Read it, and it's a real eye-opener to you and to people.
Any other comment from the audience? Yes?
I heard a brilliant thing of an Arab action that some Arab people have. When a couple are in problems and it starts to get aired around, they select a discreet, distinguished elder who goes and lives with them. And both of them know that that man is going to submit a report to the body of whether they're going to break up or whether they're not. And they're both on such good behaviour that 9 out of 10 of them don't break up.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
Another thing I think is important in all this is let not the sun go down on your wrath.
Yes,
now, people lose sight of this. What happened today, you've got to make sure it has no relationship with what happens tomorrow. And when something happens tomorrow, you don't sort of say, oh, you're always doing that. That's not Christian. When we come to Christ, he forgave us, and that's all forgotten. And we've got to adopt that attitude in our marriages. When our partner does the wrong thing, then we're to overlook it. Once the sun's gone down, it's finished with. And next day is on an entirely new footing. Now, that's something that a lot of marriages don't recognise. Things carry on. And what steamed them up today is already stoking the fire tomorrow. And it's building up. But you find you get the answers when you forget about tomorrow and you start to work on today as being a fresh day. Everything in the garden is rosy. I'm in love with my wife. She's in love with me. Hallelujah. It's all over.
Terrific. Not all of them get solved that quickly, though.
No, not only that. There's another basis, and that is this. We're both there to help one another.
Yes.
Now, if you just put your blind eye to a thing, you're not necessarily helping your partner. You're building up something that in 20 years' time is going to be too gigantic for you to do anything with. And you are better to say, now listen, I think we face this.
Yes, I sort of left that bit out.
Yeah.
You do need to address the problem and say where you have a problem.
Sure.
But then tomorrow...
The freedom to be able to speak is one of the precious things about a friendship. And I think this is what we've also got to get across, that friendship factor is very, very important in marriage.
The important thing that goes with that, let not the sun go down in wrath, is that the bottom section of that passage says, and use not what's hurtful conversation. And when you have a look at that, don't speak cuttingly to your wife. How's that?
Very good. David, how are we doing for time?
Well, Jimmy, how are
you going? Well, I'm basically done for questions. That's all.
Well, yeah, open for questions.
We're not trying to give a conclusive statement on marriage counselling, but just simply that you are likely to be exposed to this sort of thing the more weddings you do.
And the more the community sort of
Yes.
You okay.
Thanks.
There's just another thing that I do. I just thought of it while I was sitting there when I'm in the counselling session with the young people. I say to them, you're in love. Oh, the first question, why are you marrying this person? That's the first question I ask them. I want a statement from both of them as to why they're marrying this person. It's never because she's pregnant or anything like that. It's just, you know, they've always got... And you find out very quickly about this business of which one communicates the best, because they jump in with the answer straight away. The second thing I do, or the other thing I do, is I say, okay, I want you to go away. I want you to write, this is on the last counselling session, I want you to write a letter to your intended, and I wanted you to write in that letter all the wonderful things and the reasons why you are marrying them. I want you to write that down. I want you to put their name across the front, but I want you to seal the envelope, because one day you're going to have to open that and read it and be reminded as to why you married this person. When they come to me after marriage with a bit of a problem, I give them a blank sheet of paper and I put one at one end of the table and one at the other end of the table, and I say, put a line down the middle. You write there why it is you married this person, down that side, the pros as to why. You know, dedicated person, honest, good cook, good looking, this, that, and the other. Now tell me, and on the other side of the piece of paper, all the contras. What is it? He doesn't pick his pants up. He squeezes the wrong end of the toothpaste. I said, keep writing them. Don't stop. Don't stop. Write all the things that are creating the problems down there. Spends too much money. Write them all down. And then I say, bring them back together, and I say, okay, concentrating on the pros. Now, they've only got three or four written down there at this stage. They've had to write something. But when you start looking at the piddly little things that are creating the problems on this side, which are usually, in a lot of cases, the practical things, how does that stack up against this? How does that stack up against that? Now, if the guy's been unfaithful or the woman's been unfaithful or something like that, you're in, you know, a bit deeper than that. But usually some of these people have absolutely no idea in reality as to why the situation's got to where it has. And talking about these people coming to you, I had one couple arrive one night. I'd been talking to the bloke. I said, look, I'm not going to see you unless you bring your wife with you. So he packed her up and brought her down. And she was expecting a meal because he'd told her that David has invited us down for tea. Didn't tell me we'd had tea. I mean, you can get all sorts of devious ways of getting people to your place. And it was a very embarrassing situation. And we got no counselling done, and that marriage relationship disappeared. This bloke could not be honest in a fit. It proved to be the major issue. Everything he did was sort of devious and underhand. So, I mean, you're going to strike it all, and I've got nothing like the experience Jim and Grace had, but in my small experience, that's the sort of stuff you're likely to get. Desperate for the marriage to succeed, but not prepared to make changes in his own life. Everything had to be his way, and basically that's what it is, boils down to a lot of it, is selfishness. And it's only under the hand of God that those sort of things can be changed, but we, by the Spirit of God and the power of the Spirit of God, in the listening and counselling, are able to hopefully lead them along in that direction. Now, we're going to finish here early today, which is good. We've got 20 minutes till specified afternoon tea time, and then I really haven't got anything else after that other than to answer questions or if you wanted to raise any more. If we've got to that stage now, unless somebody wants to say more about this pre and post, we will go and try and handle any other questions.
David, can I just suggest that you probably need to have a list of people you can refer difficult couples to?
That's a good idea.
And we might be able to provide a list of recommended. Yeah, well, we probably, if you want to jot them down, there's a couple of psychiatrists for any person who you think has a chemical or a a physical problem that is either a mental or a physical problem which may be associated with medication or illness, you need to include a psychiatrist. And the two that we are most comfortable with at the moment would be Dr. Bill Wilkie on the Terrace and a Dr. John Warlow at Greenslopes. Now, unfortunately, you can't get those guys at the drop of a hat, but they are available sooner or later. John Warlow is in charge of a clinic, so he may assign the person to one of his understudies. But John Warlow and Bill Wilkie are pretty solid Christian men, both of different denominations from ours.
And the thing about a psychiatrist is that Medicare comes into that.
Yes, you've got a referral. The client who comes to you will have to go to their own GP and get a referral, and then Medicare can help in that situation. If you come across what you consider it to be a compulsive problem or an addictive problem, then a psychologist may be the best way to go. And Peter Janetsky from Cleveland Baptist, and there are other Christian psychologists around. There's a listing you can get from the Queensland Christian Counsellors, and that is based in Kenmore Baptist, and you can find a bunch of Christian psychologists there. We would strongly recommend Christians in this because the world view is very different among non-Christians. Peter Janetsky, I think it's...
And his
brother. I think it's J-A-N-E-T-S-K-I... Yeah, I think so.
Right. Again, Christian doctors of any particular specialty are helpful if you can identify a problem already, and you may want to have them go to people like Paul Mercer or others that we know around here. You'd probably know of Christian doctors in your community. When it comes to sexual problems, we don't mean relational problems that affect sexual function. There's a difference there. I'll repeat that. Sexual problems that are not a result of a relationship problem. But if there is, as Fred was saying earlier, a situation where the sexual anatomy does not work right, Dr. Richmond Ricard Bell in Sydney is a Christian fellow. He's been on the faculty of the med school at the Sydney University up till recently. He would probably be the most well-informed sex therapist in Christian circles in Australia. And he is accessible by telephone. He lives at Brighton Lee Sands in Sydney. He's written a book, which I haven't got here today, but it is a book that addresses the whole problem of slow or nil orgasmic response on the part of wives. And he addresses a lot of other things in that book as well. But he would be by far the best. Now, we tried to find out about another couple that were recommended to us in Brisbane here as sex therapists, and we could not get a statement from them about their Christian beliefs at all. So the assumption is that they're not Christians. And frankly, we just have a hard time recommending people to them.
Well, someone told us that they were recommending surrogate partners in
That's
therapy.
That's right, yeah.
And that put us off.
Yeah. So we would suggest them. There would be others that the Queensland Christian Counsellors Association could probably mention to you as well.
Well, see, if anybody wants to look that up in the phone book, I think it's the Christian Counsellors Association. I don't think Queensland's there. Look under C, not Q.
Oh, okay. Christian, right. Peter,
what about homosexuality?
Yes, there's a crowd in Melbourne and I think also in Sydney, Exodus.
Also here.
Also in Brisbane now? Okay, Exodus would be highly recommended. They've had considerable success in Melbourne, very much more so in the States. And the evangelical members of the Uniting Church, EMU, have researched, done a lot of research, and there's quite a a big revival going on within the Uniting Church, actually, on the matter of the authority of Scripture. But they have been forced into a situation where they've had to do their homework regarding the homosexual issues. And they have a listing, which I can get for you, of books that they are recommending to do with that, and also people who are helping out. But Exodus is highly recommended. Yes, again, it probably would drop into the case with Bill Wilkie and with John Warlow. There are books available.
Ladies of Green Slopes Baptist.
Oh, there's a couple of Ladies of Green Slopes Baptist, yes, that are also helpful. And because a lot of these people are women, and there are books available for that subject as well.
Dr. Charles
Noll. Yes. He's a psychologist, another psychologist, yes. And his wife also, Pat, is a professor at Queensland Uni. At least she was. Is she? I don't know if she's still there. Is she? Yeah, the Nollers are another good pair. Yes.
There's a couple in Toowoomba, I think, too. And I'll...
Yes. Yes.
A couple in Toowoomba, and I've forgotten their names at the moment, but my wife might remember. Okay. They are specialising in counselling full-time workers.
Yes, yeah. A Uniting Church couple. Yeah. Yes, and I haven't got their names on the tip of my tongue, but they could be contacted through the Uniting Church.
Yes.
We are in favour of couples to couples. You might have picked that up. You think it's helpful.
Jim... We've heard in the ministry that we've been involved in that there are moves towards government requiring that anyone involved in counselling and this kind of thing has to be accredited. Have you heard anything?
Yes, we haven't heard that have to be accredited, but OAC Ministries has jumped the gun on that and are taking out insurance. And our general feeling is that the more high profile you become, your church may want to look at insurance for counselling. Mm-hmm. We're living in a crazy age. Mm-hmm. And at this point, though, there's no limitation. The government recognises the pastor as a specialist. Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair comment at this point. So if you are registered as a celebrant pastor, mm-hmm. you are probably covered by that title. But
until they get you to court and rip your partner,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It doesn't be a situation.
Right.
So keep
Thanks,
it
sir.
Pretty very
I'm a plumber. Yeah, I used to work. Okay. Well, basically, I've come to the end of our program, and while we allowed till 5 o'clock, I'm quite happy that it's come to conclusion basically now. Marion has prepared afternoon tea for you. We don't want you to go away. If you haven't paid me, then please pay me. I'll survive, but only for 2 weeks.
Look, those books are for sale. People want to buy.
Good. And also, yeah, resources. I mean, you know, have a look at what, even if you haven't got the dough there today, you know what's there, you know where to go to get it. And really... Oh, they're prepared to invoice you for it too, if you would like to take it. That's good. I want to thank you for coming. I think the day's been beneficial. Probably my biggest strain now will be trying to put something together that puts it all together, but I hope to be able to do that. I'll use the tapes as well as the thing. If we got together again at some stage, it probably wouldn't be a full day. It might only be for a couple of hours. But probably the next time we got together would be if there was some major change that was initiated through the government or something like that that we really want to talk about. So in essence today, what I want to do is prepare a resume of what's gone on. I want to write a letter that I'll get a few of the guys to check with to the National Mutual and to the radio and television station and the advertising people, in relation to that ad that's on TV, just as a making a bit of a stand. And I'd...
The one about the
yeah.
Is that, was that the one? Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's the one. The National Mutual ad with the... Yeah, I think the whole thing's ridiculous. And certainly initiates marriage in the sight of the... I don't know what we need to do. Probably do before you get it. Don't worry about that. Tapes are available from Des. And I'm sure our folk who aren't... But from those, and certainly encourage them in future to attend these things, because I think, I don't know about you, some of you might like to say, have you learned anything, or is it just sort of reinforced in your mind what we know? We are a very important part of our Christian church, and I think the importance of what we do is, and we really have to be more professional, more up to date, all the in this matter. If we don't, if we're going to take a lax attitude to this thing, we are going to see it affected. Now, we need to get to our elders. We need to get into our churches. I was thinking there before, you know, Christ left 11, didn't he? And they made a difference. We ought to be back there and looking at this issue. I think we've neglected it in our church, the marriage, the preparing of our young people for it, and the care of our people after marriage. I think we've neglected it for far too long. And somewhere we've got to make a stand on it. Now's the time. And I guess out of this, if each of us can go back to our various churches and make a statement, I will follow it through with a letter in relation to the way I see elders ought to act. And so at least they've got something to talk about. And with that, virtually close the session. You just might like to commend us to the Lord, Doug, eh?